You're with us for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At this time of hardship, we witness the resiliency of our neighbors and these acts of kindness happening all around us. There's a storytelling project called Wisconsin Life, capturing the grace and beauty of Wisconsinites. And the team travels the state searching for and telling the humorous and diverse and unique tales of life in Wisconsin. And we bring you these stories twice a week. And this hour, we're exploring some recent highlights, like, you know, stories behind the story. What can you share about how you and your neighbors are coping and supporting one another? What is unique and special about Wisconsin that could be told through the lens of Wisconsin Life? We're at 800-642-1234. Maureen McCollum is host and producer of Wisconsin Life. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Hi there, Maureen. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So your stories, they stick with us. And right now, at this time that is so unprecedented and such hard news, how are you adjusting how you tell stories of Wisconsin right now?
Well, right now, it's a really fine balance in how we're approaching the Wisconsin Life stories. So on one hand, Wisconsin Life can be, at this point in time, this lovely escape and remind people that life in Wisconsin can be normal. There are great people here. There are things that make Wisconsin amazing. So we can offer that escape and sort of like this normalcy, right? Mm. And then on the other hand, we can't be completely tone deaf to the situation and pretend that life is not normal right now. So we'll still be like providing the stories kind of that people are used to, just about, you know, people's everyday lives, maybe interesting things going on in the state. You know, a lot of these stories, some of them we've recorded like a month ago. So it's nice because we have a great stockpile of stories.
You have a treasure trove. Yes, you do.
We do have a treasure trove. But we're also going to be doing a couple of crowdsourced stories coming up. I can't leave the house. Most of us can't leave the house. So we're having people send us in their stories, either by emailing us voice memos or calling my office line, and I can get, I can get people to leave voicemails for me and I can incorporate this story. So right now, the crowdsourcing story we're working on is we'd like people to share how they're coping with isolation in their day-to-day routine. So if you're living alone or if you're living with a family, do you have any tips or stories that you'd like to share about how you've reorganized your life? So if people want to send those stories in to me, then we can create these nice little stories moving forward. And hopefully it'll help us feel a little less alone.
Yeah, and we can all be a little more in touch with each other. And there's Wisconsin Project that is receiving a boatload of questions every day.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's right. So Wisconsin, as a reminder to listeners, Wisconsin is this wonderful listener engagement project. So our catchphrase essentially is you ask the questions and we answer. You hear a lot of these Wisconsin stories on Wisconsin Life. So you might hear like, what's up with cheeseheads? Why are we called the Badger State? Why do people eat cannibal sandwiches? But right now, obviously, we're living in unprecedented times and a lot of people have questions about COVID-19. So we've received a number of questions about COVID-19 and all of our Wisconsin efforts have shifted towards answering those questions. And I would say the WPR News team and now a lot of the Ideas Network shows, they're compiling these listener questions and they're asking the experts about questions regarding health, the economy, housing, animals. So, for example, this week, Governor Tony Evers, he answered listener questions about the state's response to COVID-19. We've had doctors on answering questions one after the other about like symptoms of COVID-19, but also about social distancing. We also had a professor on this week who answered a lot of questions that listeners had about pets and livestock.
Yeah.
So we know that these questions will keep rolling in and they're going to keep evolving as the situation does. And so the WPR News team and the Ideas Network talk shows, they're really working hard to find the answers to these questions.
Yeah, and I'm really impressed, too, that hundreds of questions have come in and teams across the organization have answered hundreds of questions.
Oh, yeah.
Talking with Maureen.
I mean,
Yeah, go ahead.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Talking with Maureen McCollum, host and producer of Wisconsin Life. What's unique about your community that you think would make a great Wisconsin Life segment? How are you coping with the isolation right now? What is your family doing? Do you have curiosities about Wisconsin or COVID-19 that you want answered? Blend it all, your questions, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Maureen, recently a listener asked Wisconsin about how the state capitol ended up on the Isthmus in Madison. How did you set out to find that answer?
That's right. So WPR digital news editor John K. Wilson, he answered this question, and he went straight to the experts. He talked with the fine folks at the Wisconsin Historical Society, because they're generally our go-to when it comes to all things history in Wisconsin.
So in 1836, territorial lawmakers met in Belmont to select a capital city. And we have a bit of tape here. Bethany Brander of the Wisconsin Historical Society telling WPR how a politician, James Duane Doty, lobbied for the state capital to be in Madison.
So when Doty arrives in Belmont, he comes with a bunch of buffalo robes. And so when he gets there, he's hanging out these buffalo robes. He's showing people his map, telling them about his paper city called Madison. And he named Madison after the recently departed President James Madison. He was kind of playing to people's patriotic sensibilities here, and it worked.
So being pretty ambitious for a city that doesn't exist yet on the map,
right.
Maureen, what's up with the buffalo robes?
So a couple things going on there. So Doty had purchased, I should back up and say that the land that is now Madison, this was Ho-Chunk land. But Doty had gone and he purchased Madison, but, you know, the streets had not been developed yet or any of that. So when he went to this meeting in Belmont, he essentially brought these buffalo robes. Let's just say it was a bribe. he was trying to convince people that they should also buy into this real estate that he had purchased, and also in the meantime, create and make Madison the capital. And so, you know, as he was trying to convince them, he just happened to have all these buffalo robes to hand out to people.
How do your teams of reporters and contributors go about searching for these answers? Because it seems like this can also take quite a while to get into the history.
You know, it's interesting because, like, with any Wisconsin story, it's not, we don't really approach it much differently than any other story. So maybe I would get the idea, like, who built the state capitol? And we could do a lovely Wisconsin Life story and a Wisconsin story on that. But with Wisconsin, what we love is being able to incorporate the listener who asked the question into the story. Sometimes people don't want to be on the air, and that's fine. You know, we'll just say, you know, Amanda from Madison submitted that question. Other times we'll have people come along on the reporting adventure with us.
Oh, cool.
And so that's really great because then, you know, that listener, they'll probably have other questions that none of us are going to think of. You know, we all come from different perspectives. So not only is it a great way to just incorporate more voices in the question asking, but just involving the public more in the reporting that we do. You know, you all on the Ideas Network talk shows, it's fantastic because people can call in and voice their opinions and ask questions. But it's a little different, as you know, like on the news reporting side, usually the reporter's all alone. So it's nice when you can bring someone along and just kind of show them the way.
We're talking with Wisconsin Life host and producer Maureen McCollum on a tour of some memorable stories that have come together recently. Wisconsin Life brings out all these cool voices from around our state, and we get to explore the nooks and crannies that make our home home. So what is something in your backyard that you'd love to see turned into a Wisconsin Life? What stories can you share about how you've reorganized your upended life right now and helped out a neighbor, helped out in some way during this pandemic? Give us a call, share your experience, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute for more Wisconsin Weekend here on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is Wisconsin Weekend, not all things considered, despite what you're hearing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is Don Vagley's original composition of All Things Considered, theme song from 1971. So Vagley was a WHA employee, and he composed much of the music that listeners heard on the radio. And our partners at Wisconsin Life, they dug into the history of his music and the instruments he used to create it. So what do you want to know about the history of the All Things Considered theme song? Do you remember hearing it as a kid? Did you wake up to it from nap time or accompany it, you know, on the ride home from daycare? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We're spending this hour with the host and producer of Wisconsin Life, Maureen McCollum, and exploring highlights of Wisconsin's storytelling. And so, Maureen, you know, you hear that music and you realize that there's been some evolution to it.
But I really love that original song.
So, you know, there was this question about Don Vagley. Can you tell us about what all prompted this?
Yeah, so Don Vagley, as you mentioned, he was the longtime music director for WHA, which is now known as Wisconsin Public Radio. He was this incredibly talented piano and organ player. He played radio interstitials on programs like School of the Air back, you know, decades ago. And in 1971, he was tapped by his colleagues to write the theme song for All Things Considered, which at the time was NPR's first daily news magazine. And he did that, and he spent the last 10 years of his career really composing a lot of music on synthesizers. And this Wisconsin question was sparked by our colleague, Nigel O'Shea. He had seen this picture of Don Vagley hanging up, standing in front of all these synthesizers, and he had always wondered about it.
Nigel, are you there?
I am.
Hi, Nigel.
Hey, Nigel.
Hi, everybody.
So what made you curious about Don Vagley synthesizers?
I mean, it's a pretty simple story. I as I go to my desk every day down the hall, I pass Director Mike Crane's office, and that actually used to be Don Vagley's electrosonic studio. So there's a picture actually posted on the door of Don standing in front of, like Maureen described, in front of his huge bank of synthesizers. And, you know, day after day going by that, and seeing such kind of huge technology just standing there in what's now, you know, a normal office with desks and chairs or whatever. I was just like, wow, where did that stuff go? Why don't we have, you know, it was such an impressive array of technology to be used on site in what has become like an office space.
Yeah, it's like you're unearthing an ancient city.
Right, no, exactly. And honestly, at WPR, since we are so history, you know, there's a lot of that. I see a lot of technology that I wish and wonder and you know, could get to know more about, I guess.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the 1976 version of the song. I hear an earworm developing 5 years into this project. The worm's getting longer and longer.
Oh, my gosh. Always and forever.
So, you know, Maureen, how did he create this full sound with these synthesizers that are now in this office?
So Don was given a lot of freedom to really experiment. I mean, he was such a talented piano player that he was able to bring, you know, those skills and that history of playing piano and playing organ on the air. And when WHA had purchased these synthesizers for him, you know, this was really cutting edge technology. And there's actually a lovely interview with him and Susan Stamberg from sometime in the 70s, where he's basically saying he's making it up as he goes along. I think he's probably a little harder on himself than any of us would say. But yeah, he had a number of synthesizers, and he'd layer these parts into a multi-track tape recordings, and it was super time-consuming. I'm going to let Nigel talk about that because he's a little more of an expert on how that stuff worked more than I am.
Yeah, Nigel, you're a technical director. How did he do this?
That's a good question. And actually, that's a question I ask myself a lot, and that's part of, like, my curiosity because, honestly, I don't know. like specifically his work process or his workflow of how he did it. But essentially, he had all these synthesizers going into a soundboard, a multi-track recorder, and he would have to manipulate essentially multi-track recording to create some of these pieces. A lot of these synthesizers are monophonic versus polyphonic, meaning that when you hit the keyboards, you can't play chords. You can only play single notes. So a lot of times when he's doing chord voicings and stuff, he would actually have to re-record that section just to get the chord down. But to be honestly, perfectly honest with you, I would love to see like a schematic of how he set everything up together.
So he must have been doing some layering here in order to make this music. We're talking with Nigel O'Shea, technical director at Wisconsin Public Radio. Maureen McCollum here, host and producer of Wisconsin Life. And they've been recently reporting on the synthesizers of Don Vagley, a Wisconsin Public Radio broadcasting great. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how he created this music? What is a particular story in Wisconsin that you would like to share about great music? You can call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. So, Maureen, you actually set out to find these instruments, which are apparently long gone from WPR or anywhere in our basements. So were you optimistic that you were going to find them?
Oh, Kate, I'm always optimistic. I am absurdly confident that I can find the info that I need. And maybe that's just kind of the reporter in me. But this story was super tough because we couldn't find records of where these instruments went anywhere. So we were solely relying on the memories from people, essentially from like the 70s and 80s. Don Vagley, he retired in 1982. And after he had retired, they had really quickly auctioned his gear off, like almost immediately. So we were able to find some people who remembered that auction. Luckily, we found one person who ended up purchasing a couple pieces from that auction. And that was Tom Nonis.
Yeah, Tom Nonis. And let's hear a little bit from him.
When I think about his classic tune, do, 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 having heard that and then going and meeting the man who had created it and seeing where he had created it, it was inspirational. I am indebted to him, really.
So, Nigel, what was it like meeting this person, Tom Nonis, and finding, seeing these instruments up close?
Well, it was cool because it went from like, you know, vague curiosity about this photo to actually kind of unfolding part of my legacy. You know, as a technical director and a network operator, you know, I have to think about a lot of the technical aspects, including music that we put on our airwaves. And so to see another public media person, someone that became a music director and a sound designer for Wisconsin Public Television now, Wisconsin Public Broadcast,
PBS Wisconsin, yeah.
Yeah, Tom Nonis. It was just kind of like I was seeing someone, maybe a closer antecedent to me in the realm of WPR and the technical and sound direction of WPR. So it was just really cool to hear his story because he was inspired by a man. And then hearing that, I was kind of like, oh, okay, so now I am a part of this story as well because I'm carrying on the legacy of our radio network.
So, Maureen, just to clarify, did you track down all of the equipment or just some of the equipment?
We tracked down some of the equipment. So Tom had two synthesizers in his basement. He had an ARP Quadra and an ARP Soloist, and he still uses these pieces, and they're part of his electronic music studio, which was so amazing, and Nigel and I had so much fun down at Tom's studio. But we're still looking for a Putney synthesizer, and the Putney is super important because that is the instrument that Don Vagley composed the first All Things Considered theme on. We're also looking for a Moog synthesizer that was Don Vagley's, and that's like this huge piece of equipment. I mean, there's multiple parts to it in that photo that Nigel saw. After the story originally aired, we received a few leads on where the Moog possibly could be. We still have to confirm some of that, but it sounds like the Moog may be a bit scattered around the world, actually.
Wow. I love this detective work.
Oh, it was really fun. And it was super fun working with Nigel on this because I learned so much from Nigel, just about the music and just thinking differently about Don Begley's legacy. So I really appreciated that, Nigel.
Yeah, Nigel. Yeah,
The thing is, I think people think of public radio first and foremost as people and content. So we're talking about news, we're talking about stories that people generate. And of course, that's like the main part of what this informational service is. But there's also a glue that holds it all together. And I think Don Begley's story is part of that glue. And his work towards the practicality of the music used for public radio is huge and continues to influence us today.
Well, Nigel, thanks for making time for us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Nigel Shea, Technical Director and Network Operator at WPR. So many WPR folks contribute to Wisconsin Life, and we have Wisconsin Life host and producer Maureen McCollum staying with us, taking us on a tour of the memorable storytelling projects from her recent work. Do you have curiosities about Wisconsin? What questions about the state would you like WPR to answer? And how are you seeing your community come together at this time of crisis? Share your piece of the state with us, 800-642-1234. Coming up, we learn about Milwaukee's first hip-hop song and how Joni Mitchell left her mark on Wisconsin, specifically Lake Mendota. There's more conversation right after this news update on the Ideas Network.
It's dramatic, it's implied without static. But I'm not only deed, if that's emphatic. My rhymes give a sound that I kind over nine, but appropriate in battle. Whenever it's time, you know.
Excuse me, Peachy.
No, it is Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The song you're hearing is called A-Tack on the Wax, recorded by the artist Speech in 1985. It's credited as Milwaukee's first influential hip-hop song. And we're going to get some of the history behind that track as we're on a tour of Wisconsin Life Stories. Maureen McCollum stays with us. She's host and producer of Wisconsin Life. So, Maureen, just before we go to hip-hop, let us first backtrack here. Susan from Baraboo just sent us an email saying that she's an elementary music teacher, and a few years ago, she acquired a 4-CD set of Don Begley's composition compiled by his son. Do we know about him working with his son?
Oh, yes. So, Jim Begley is Don Begley's son, and he was a huge part of this story coming together, and Jim has spent, you know, a good part of his life and working with his siblings too and compiling all the recordings that he can find of his father's. So it is this incredible treasure trove, this 4-disc set. It's called Beautiful and Lovely by Don Begley. And it has everything from, you know, the organ interstitials that would be played on WHA. It has recordings from Let's Sing, you know, a former WHA show. It has all sorts of these synthesizer songs. You know, some are only like 15 seconds long, some are a couple minutes long. It has commercials that he recorded. It's everything. There's interviews that he did. It's a really, really amazing box set. And yeah, I think if you can find it, I highly recommend it. Also, if someone is interested in getting a copy, you can reach out to me because I can connect you with Jim Begley. Don's son, who just lives over next door in Minnesota.
All right. Well, Susan, thank you for sending that. Appreciate it. Let's move on to hip-hop, Maureen. Our friends at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee sent you a question about Wisconsin, specifically about Backspin.
So actually, Backspin is a podcast that Radio Milwaukee released last year, and they went out to answer the question, what was Milwaukee's first hip-hop song? I am a huge music nerd, also love anything about Milwaukee and Wisconsin history. So I just ate up this podcast. I went through Backspin, I think, in like 2 or 3 days. And I had reached out to them and asked if we could share some of that content on Wisconsin Life. And luckily, they said yes.
All right. So how did they find the answer to their question about the first hip-hop song?
So they found out pretty quickly that answering what was Milwaukee's first hip-hop song is actually a super complicated question. So hosts Justin Barney and Tyrone Miller, along with executive producer Nate Imig, they interviewed dozens of musicians, DJs, music fans, historians. And what they discovered was what was Milwaukee's first hip hop song. It came down to these two songs. So there was Class A, and that was a song that came out from the Majestics in the early 80s. The Majestics were sort of this like R&B group, and they produced a rap song, but or a hip hop song, but it was kind of like a business decision. So it was like one and done. And it's like this really fun, semi cheesy, like disco rap song.
Nice.
Like kind of reminds me of, yeah. Anyways, I highly recommend going and checking it out. But then there was this other song, Attack on the Wax by Attack, which is a hip hop crew in Milwaukee that came out a couple years later. And what they found was Attack on the Wax, that was super influential because it just, after that song came out, it inspired a lot of other people in Milwaukee to go out and create hip hop songs.
Well, here is Speech himself describing what he was trying to accomplish in those early days of Milwaukee hip hop.
You know, like I didn't want to be just a quote unquote Milwaukee artist. You know what I mean? Like I knew that Milwaukee had to rise to the occasion of New York because New York was defining hip hop. And, you know, I wanted Milwaukee to have that same legitimate sound. And I feel like we accomplished it with that EP.
So beyond the song itself, what did you learn about Speech's impact on Milwaukee hip hop?
Yeah, so Speech was one of the members of that hip hop crew Attack, which released Attack on the Wax, which we heard right at the beginning here. And Speech, a lot of people would say, you know, he helped other musicians. He helped other hip hop artists. He supported artists. You know, he really helped pave the way and kind of helped create this community surrounding hip hop music in the city. Speech then went on to go to college in Atlanta. And then once Speech got there, he went on and started, co-founded the group Arrested Development, is like incredibly successful, you know, hip hop crew from the early 90s. They went on to win 2 Grammys. Probably their most famous songs are Tennessee, People Every Day, Mr. Wendell. Super fun. And Arrested Development was incredibly groundbreaking at that point in time in the music scene.
Yeah, now you're talking about my era.
Yeah.
Maureen McCollum is host and producer of Wisconsin Life. We're rounding up the recent stories she's been tracking down and telling, everything from hip hop now to Joni Mitchell. You can join in with your stories about Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So moving on to another part of music history, tell us about the Wisconsin Life story involving Joni Mitchell.
Oh, Joni Mitchell. Love her so much, first of all.
Mm.
So like many great ideas, this story about Joni Mitchell came to me while I entered the bowels of an internet wormhole one day. but luckily, it was a Joni Mitchell wormhole, so not too dangerous. I had come across information that the photos featured on her 1976 album Hejira, that they were shot on Lake Mendota by the Edgewater Hotel here in Madison. And that just blew my mind. I said, we have to do a Wisconsin Life on this. This is amazing. I reached out to writer Dean Robbins and thought he would be the best person to tell this story. He does a really great job of taking like historical pop culture and writing around it. He ended up teaming up with technical director Steve Gotcher, who Hejira is one of his favorite albums. So together they created this beautiful story, just bringing the history and then the music of Hejira together, just to tell this story about how did photos from Lake Mendota end up on this classic 1970s Joni Mitchell album.
Yeah, well, let's hear from journalist Dean Robbins with some of the details of that day.
Mitchell came to Madison for a February concert at the Dane County Coliseum in the midst of an ice storm. She'd just broken up with her longtime boyfriend and called off the rest of her troubled tour, so her emotional state was melancholy in the extreme.
Oh, well, I would love to just want, it makes for wanting to hear more. Like, tell me more, right?
So after that day that that the photo shoot took place, she went in to downtown. I think she went to like a sporting goods store on State Street, bought a pair of black skates, put them on, and off she went. And she just started skating on Lake Mendota. Her photographer at the time ended up following her around. And these photos are just so beautiful because she's wearing this huge, long, like black cape, like jacket, and she has this black hat on. So when you're looking at the Hejira album, you'll notice like trees surrounding Lake Mendota kind of in the background. The main photo on the front, that was actually taken from a different photo shoot. But when you open the album up, you'll see her skating, and that's on Lake Mendota. When you flip the album over on the back, you'll see a photo of Picnic Point. And then there's also some professional skaters in there too. But it's just this like beautiful, just these haunting photos. And when you listen to that album too, I just feel like it fits the essence of that album so perfectly. And it was cool once we shared this story. Again, I'm a music nerd, so I love these types of stories, but it was so awesome once we posted it online, how many people were commenting about how they remember going to that concert, you know, rumors like, oh, my friend was working at the store when she came in and bought those skates. And those are like, I love when we have those moments when these stories bring people together. Also, something I'm very proud about, Joni Mitchell's people ended up sharing this story through their social media, which I know sounds kind of silly, but like it made us feel like we got the seal of approval from
like
Joni
you
Mitchell
arrived, right?
And like that story now, she has an amazing archive on her website. So this Wisconsin Life story lives on Joni Mitchell's website too, which like that's pretty amazing.
That is incredible. And Rolling Stone called Hejira one of the best album covers ever.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, it's just, it's so like the photos are so haunting. And I think like when you listen to that album, it is like, you know, you can just feel this like, I don't know if pain is the right word, but just this like aching and longing. And like whenever I listen to that album, I just feel like I'm on this like meandering journey with Joni. And I think that those photos really capture the essence of that album perfectly.
Interesting, too, that people remember it and feel that same feeling, that you can actually see the trend lines tick up when you talk about those images.
Oh, absolutely. I think like, you know, music is so personal. And think of, you know, you talked about right now, like Arrested Development, that was your era. When you listen and you think about Arrested Development, it transports you back to this point in time. And I think that a lot of the people who lived through the 70s were there alongside Joni Mitchell. I think that took them back to this special place and this special moment in time. And I'm really, really happy that we were able to do that with Wisconsin Life.
Well, we have Maureen McCollum as our guide this hour. She's the host and producer of Wisconsin Life. We're hearing the song Hejira by the legendary Joni Mitchell here in just a moment. And the photos on the jacket of that album were taken on a very cold, frigid day in February 1976 on Lake Mendota. So what curiosities do you have about Wisconsin? What would you like Wisconsin Life to pursue? There's still time to share. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Back in a moment. Let's just spend some time with Joni Mitchell right here, Wisconsin Weekend, and a celebration of Wisconsin Life on the Ideas Network.
I'm sitting in some cafe, a defector from the petty wars that shall shut love away. There's comfort in melancholy when there's no need to explain. It's just as natural as the weather in this moody sky today.
It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There is this storytelling unit at Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin that works to draw us closer to our state. Wisconsin Life celebrates the uniquenesses all around us, and we're on a highlights tour from some of the recent work. Is there a question you want Wisconsin to dig into? What do you want to share about how our people respond at a time of great need? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Maureen McCollum is host and producer of Wisconsin Life, and she stays with us. So, Maureen, I have to say here, Sue was really happy that you answered her emails. So,
good.
Yeah, it's just nice to have people come together here. Let's move on to writers and artists across the state contributing to Wisconsin Life. And here's a bit from Aracely Esparza about the tradition of making tortillas with her family.
She gets the flour. She gets the flour and the salt. She gets the flour, the salt, and the water. Hungry for my cloud tortillas.
Oh, my goodness. You know, this was a recent one, Maureen, and you couldn't help but just be so drawn in. It felt like poetry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Aracely Esparza is one of my favorite, not to play favorites, but I absolutely love working with her because sometimes she'll write just kind of like your straight up traditional essay. But she's also submitted these poems for me. And I think that, she's a super talented writer, but I also think that just hearing poetry amidst like a talk show or in the middle of a news magazine, I think it's a really nice change of pace. It helps us just kind of slow down and really just take in all the senses and really almost like it just can transport your brain to a different place than maybe you were expecting to go when you've tuned into the news or like a heavy talk show, you know?
Yeah.
Anytime I can feature Aracely, I try to. She's also the host of a podcast called Midwest Mujeres, and I highly recommend people listen to that podcast as well.
You've been leading Wisconsin Life for 2 years now, but have contributed stories for the project for much longer. How has this project grown on you over the years?
Yeah. So when I was a reporter based in La Crosse before moving here to Madison. And when I was a reporter, one of my favorite things to do was contribute stories to Wisconsin Life. I love reporting on the hard news, but I always just found like doing Wisconsin Life pieces was a way to almost like step back, take a breather, refresh, but also be a little more creative than you would in like a traditional news story. My predecessor, Erica Janik, she set such a great foundation for Wisconsin Life before coming into the job. Like she created these great partnerships with organizations across the state. She's a writer and an historian, so she created these great relationships with other writers and historians throughout Wisconsin. So I'm almost like I approached it by like building on her legacy, but also reaching out to people who are a little more in my wheelhouse. So like different freelance reporters in the state. I would say probably the biggest change that we've seen since I've taken this on is the addition of Wisconsin, kind of bringing it back full circle, like incorporating these listener generated questions and trying to involve the public more in Wisconsin and Wisconsin Life in a way that we haven't before, just approaching the stories in a different way.
Yeah. Well, bringing it back full circle to what you're working on now and COVID-19, how can people reach you?
So for Wisconsin, if people have questions about COVID-19, they can go to WPR.org. You'll see a box at the top that says, what are your questions about COVID-19? You can also go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's WHYSCONSIN.
Spell it right, Maureen.
You can see like the I know. I'm like, but you can see the list of questions and stories that have been answered so far. As far as this crowdsourcing question and stories that I would like to do, the easiest thing to do would be go to Wisconsin Life's Facebook page or Wisconsin Life's Twitter feed right now to see the questions that we're asking. People can reach out to me directly. That's Maureen McCollum at WPR.org. I'm happy to answer any questions. If they want to call and leave a voicemail, they can do that too.
And
I've listed that on our Facebook page.
Perfect. Maureen, thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate, and stay safe.
You too. Maureen McCollum, host and producer of Wisconsin Life. Earlier, we heard from Nigel O'Shea, technical director here. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about Wisconsin's late winter sugar maple season.
Every year, without fail, winter has a sweet grand finale. Do you know what it is? It's sugar maple season. Norman Gilliland spent some time among the maple trees and followed the process from sap to syrup.
Dan and Liz and their family have 175 sugar maples just across the line in the UP. About 15 years ago, Dan's father, Ed, began tapping the trees. If you're going to try it, some important pointers. First, it's a good idea to make sure that you actually have a maple tree. And then make sure that the tree is alive. And then there's one more detail from Ed.
It's kind of important that you have the angle of the tap down. And we've had people that have tapped trees and it's been slightly angled into the tree and the sap doesn't come out.
Dan's found a promising tree. And if the drilling and tapping go according to plan, you put in a tap and hang up a bucket, and sooner or later, you hear this. Let's put on some snowshoes and go check some trees that were tapped earlier. The average maple tree will produce about 10 or 12 gallons of sap per season. During the warmth of day, starch stored in the roots for the winter rises through the trunk as sugary sap. Tapping doesn't affect the health of the tree. A healthy tree can produce sap for 100 years or more. Let's have a look in some of the buckets. Time now to haul it to the sugar shack, where it's poured into a storage tank.
Okay, so we've collected about 7 gallons of sap on our first run to the trees, and we're going to go back to our storage tank and dump the sap in there, and that's where we'll be collecting it until we're ready to boil.
The family has built a handsome and efficient new sugar shack because a year or so ago at dinner time, the original shack burned down for some reason. From the storage tank, the sap is pumped into the head tank, and from the head tank, it goes into the float pan, which has a device that regulates the depth of the sap in the main evaporator tank, and from there, it flows into the finishing tank, where it reposes in a second float pan. But how are you going to keep the boiler hot? Why doesn't the sap boil over and make a gooey mess all over the floor? For the watchful custodian of the process, there's a simple trick. Poking a match tipped with butter into the hot, bubbling sap, which makes it drop back down like magic. In the float pan, evaporation begins to turn the watery sap into viscous syrup.
And we're ready for what we call a draw. And so the temperature is about 7 degrees above the boiling point of water. And we also use a hydrometer. And if the hydrometer is floating, then we know we have syrup.
Congratulations, you have syrup. But unless you're going to haul it out in buckets, there's one more step in your syrup odyssey. It's convenient to put it in sterile mason jars. It all boils down to this. At the end of the season, by about April 15th, your 175 sugar maples will have yielded you something like 1,200 gallons of sap that you have processed into 30 gallons of potent maple syrup. Now you can kick back and look forward to next year when that otherwise awkward time between winter and spring brings your next chance to reap a sweet reward. In the meantime, bon appetit.
Norman Gilliland is a writer, producer, and host at Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Just a heads up on our programming plans here. Join us tonight for a special broadcast of Here and Now from our partners at PBS Wisconsin for the latest on COVID-19. Host Frederica Freiberg will talk with Governor Evers. We'll also hear about the work being done by medical teams from state epidemiologist Dr. Ryan Westergaard. That's tonight at 7:30 right here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's Wisconsin Weekend on the Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.